Welcome to this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV with me, Susan Madaris. Today, I'm sitting down with author and intellectual Stephen Schlesinger to talk about CIA activities abroad and the relevance of the United Nations in this time and age. So stay tuned. Stephen Schlesinger is an adjunct fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. He is the former director of the World Policy Institute at the New School University in New York City. For 12 years, he served as New York Governor Mario Cuomo's speechwriter and foreign policy advisor. He is a frequent contributor to the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, The Nation magazine, and the New York Observer. In 1978, he was a finalist for the National Magazine Award. You're the son of one of history's most famous intellectual figures, the late Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and it was him that popularized the term imperial presidency during the Nixon era. In his book, The Imperial Presidency, how did he shape your views in international politics?
Well, I think it kind of crystallized a feeling that was true among many Americans at the time of the Nixon era, which is that a president is somebody who is subject to the law of this country and is not allowed to violate it without penalty. Nixon believed both privately and publicly that what a president did was right, and it didn't matter whether it was contrary to the legal system. So yes, I very much approved of what my father had written, and I think it's true today that that title, Imperial Presidency, which was the title of his book about the Nixon era, is still reverberates in our contemporary times in American history.
And there seems to be a rise and fall in the way this term is used, imperial presidency. Is there a difference on how American presidents react to this term between Democrats and Republicans, and how the public conceives America's imperialism, so to say?
Well, I think there's a distinction between the two political parties in the United States, between Republicans and the Democrats. The Democrats tend to be internationalist-minded, multilateral-minded. Republicans are much more nationalist. And nationalism is a form of imperialism, because if you believe that your country is right all the time, you feel that you can do anything you wish around the globe. And under Reagan, a Republican, under George W. Bush, another Republican, there was a feeling in Washington that the United States could unilaterally decide the fate of other countries. Whereas under Clinton, who was a Democrat, and Carter, another Democrat during that time, both believed in that you should use the multilateral functions of like the United Nations and your alliances that were part of the democracy, democratic states of the world. So in that sense, imperialism seems to be more associated with the Republicans than it does with the Democrats.
And do you think in this age and time we're seeing the end of American imperialism as we once knew it, notably in the previous administration and during the Reagan administration in the United States?
I think under the new president, President Obama, there's been a significant change in America's attitude towards imperialism. I think Obama made very clear during his presidential campaign that he was committed to multilateralism. And I think that started to be seen around the world. One of the reasons why he's so popular in practically every nation on the planet this time is because he's been willing to reach out to those constituencies that in the past have been put off by American ways. And I'm talking about the Islamic community. His speech in Cairo, which he gave last month, was significant in the sense that it the Muslim community, that he was willing to talk to them and treat them with respect. And so I think that's been a significant change in American foreign policy.
Bitter Fruit relates to the sordid tale of how the U.S. government overthrew a democratically elected president in Guatemala on behalf of a Boston-based banana company, United Fruit, eventually plunging that small country into a civil war that killed over 200,000 people. It was a New York Times notable book selection on its publication in 1982 and is considered a classic in the circles of American foreign policy and international affairs. It has sold over 100,000 copies so far. I asked Stephen, What led him? Exposé of CIA activities in Guatemala.
Well, you may recall that in the 1970s, there was something called the Church Committee that investigated the abuses of the CIA. This was another outgrowth of the abuses that had happened under the Nixon administration. And what they exposed was the fact that the CIA had been deeply involved in ousting a democratically elected government in Guatemala. But there was very little beyond that expose to suggest what really had the full story behind that. So I thought to myself, there's never been a book written about it, and this is one of the most terrible things the American government has ever done. I thought it was very important for the full story to be would know in the future to prevent this kind of activity by Washington. And that was really the basis of why I wrote the book.
And how did the United States orchestrate this coup?
Well, it was done very clearly because it was at the height of the Cold War. So much of what the CIA was doing was totally secret. I mean, most of the American people and most of the U.S. Congress knew nothing about what the CIA's machinations were at that time. What happened is that there was a very large American corporation called the United Fruit Company in Guatemala, which owned most of the land in the country. And it was a banana. It produced bananas. And it was facing a Guatemalan government, again, democratically elected, which believed that much of the land that this company owned should be given to the peasants of Guatemala who had no land at all. This land that was seized by the Guatemalan government was not even being used by this big company, the United Fruit Company. So when the president at that time, named Arbenz, took over that land under a land reform program, the United Fruit Company went to the CIA and said, listen, we can stand this. You've got to intervene and over the government so we can get our land back. And that was really the basis of the coup.
When we read about accounts of what happened in Guatemala and the coup, psychological warfare was prominent in the operations. The CIA planned to make heavy use of rumors among the people, pamphleteering, poster campaigns, and most of all, the use of radio, the mass media of the time. So the question is, did the CIA hope that word of mouth in Guatemala would help promote its propaganda campaign, so to say?
I think there's no question that that was true. As I said earlier, this happened at the height of the Cold War, so there was terrific fear of communism. And what the Eisenhower administration did and the CIA did was use that fear to convince both people in our country and also abroad that the communists were about to take over in Guatemala. Now, it is true there was a small communist party in the Guatemalan parliament, but it didn't control anything. Yet, these rumors were spread that the Marxists and the Soviets were infiltrating, you know, on the beachheads of Guatemala and were going to spread communism throughout Central America and eventually through Mexico to the borders of the United States. So the CIA orchestrated this whole plot in a way that was so comprehensive and fear-mongering that they were able to support a small exile group of right-wingers to overthrow that government and do it without feeling that they were going to be exposed at all.
You know, today when we read about accounts on the engagement between the CIA and the U.S. government, notably in past administration, we often find that there was a sense of disengagement between the CIA and the White House. Did we also see that disengagement during the coup d'etat in Guatemala as well?
No, actually, the CIA was totally under control of the Eisenhower administration. As you may recall, the Secretary of State at that time was a man named John Foster Dulles. And who ran the CIA? His brother, Alan Dulles. So there was a family connection between the two of them. And everything that Alan Dulles did at the CIA was approved by John Foster Dulles in the State Department. And the two of them, in collaboration with Eisenhower, were able to not only overthrow the Guatemalan government, but also a year earlier, the Iranian government. So this was a very much a kind of notion that, ideological notion that this was going to be rolling back communism around the globe. That was the whole theme of what was going on under Dwight Eisenhower.
You said earlier that you were targeting the American public when writing this book. What were the lessons that were learned during the Guatemala coup?
Well, the problem with gleaning lessons out of the coup was that it was totally secret. Nobody knew at the time that it had happened and that the CIA had been involved. It wasn't until many years later that the information started coming out about what America had done. But I do think my book and other books about both Guatemala and Iran showed to the American people that in both cases, the U.S. government had committed great crimes. We'd overthrown two countries in which the leadership had been elected in democratic elections. And so I think it may have immunized the United States for a period of time against further kind of unilateral attempts to undermine, subvert, and eventually depose other governments.
And do you see a sense of similarity the way the previous administration orchestrated its war on terror and previous misadventures abroad by U.S. governments?
Yes, I do. I think George Bush, like other Republican presidents, was a nationalist. He believed that America is right in every takes, that it's kind of American exceptionalism, it's called, that we are unique. We have virtues that transcend any other state. What we do is the right thing. And I think when he invaded Iraq in 2003, that was part of the ideological reasoning behind action. So I do think that he is, in a sense, part of the lineage that goes back to Dwight Eisenhower and those coups in Iran and Guatemala and preceding administration back to the days that we've just been through under Bush.
Why did the American administration lose on winning the hearts and minds of the public with its plans to bring democracy to the Middle East?
Well, I think that we went into Iraq under democracy on that. We have the right saying we have a democratic system. No, that should happen with the, in that country alone. They're the ones who should make that decision. Just the way now there's a, because people want to themselves determine their own fates. So I think that we have lost the hearts and minds of people when we do things like that. What is the most important to is lead by an example. We have democratic values here in the United States. We should uphold those democratic values. We should support those people who wish for democracy abroad. But we should not intervene. This is not our role. We are not the world's policemen. And I think that is the one we drew up what happened under George W. Bush.
Act of Creation tells a pivotal and little-known story of the creation of the United Nations at a 1940 conference. The birth very global in 2004, the book Harry S. Truman Award.
I wrote the book as a period from the mid-90s to the year 2003 when it was published. And I wrote it because the book, which we've just talked about, called Bitter Fruit, which is about one of the great crimes the American government has ever committed, overthrowing a democratically elected administration. I thought it was very important to talk about one of the great achievements the American government has ever made, and that was the creation of the United Nations, which is truly a product of the U.S. imagination. It was Franklin Roosevelt had decided he wanted to be the signal outcome of the terrible devastation of the Second World War. He felt that for 60 million people died in the Second World War. What was the point of all those people dying? What was the achievement to bring people devastation of that of those 5 years? And he thought the most important thing was to create a national security organization which would guarantee that war would not happen again in the future. And therefore, the U.S. government organized something called the San Francisco Conference, which brought together 50 nations right at the end of the Second World War to draft a charter the UN Charter, which would create this organization that would bring every nation on the planet together to make sure, in a notion of collective security, that there would be no more terrible conflicts that we had just gone through, like the Second World War.
And there has been a lot of argument regarding the relevance of the United Nations in this time and age. Would you argue differently?
I think the United Nations has had its ups and downs. I mean, it has not stamped out war. We see conflict all over the planet in this period right now. But what it has done has created a forum for countries that are in conflict to come together in a peaceful setting to try to work out agreements for a end of conflict. It has also produced a continuing a unit called the Security Council, which can be called into session at any time during in any year to deal with the outbreak of war. And the Security Council is small. It's composed of only 15 nations, but it plays a very important role in making sure that a turmoil in one country doesn't spread to other countries and spins out of control and leads to a much larger kind of conflict that can produce terrible devastation around the globe. So it's like a fire station. You know, when there's a fire, you call up the station to get the firemen come to your house to stamp out the fire. And that's the role the UN plays. It helps stamp out the fire in times of crisis.
And do you think that perhaps because the five permanent members of the United Nations have veto power, it might undermine the role of other member states?
Well, you know, when the Security Council was first set up at this 1945 conference in San Francisco, there was a lot of dissent among the smaller countries about five nations getting the veto. And that disagreement over how the Security Council should operate has been going on for the last 65 years at the UN. Just 3 years ago, the UN went through a big reform effort, and again, there was an attempt to change the Security Council. It has never been successful because the five countries that have the veto, the United States, Russia, Great Britain, France, and China, do not want to give up the veto. And they don't want to allow other countries to have it. And you're right, it is there's a great deal of question about the legitimacy of decisions by the Security Council if only those five nations, which were the five most powerful nations at the end of the Second World War, should today, in a time where power realities are totally different, should still have that authority. And yes, there is a question about whether you should expand the Security Council, bring in nations like Japan, Germany, Brazil, South Africa, whether they would then give more legitimacy to the Security Council. This is an unresolved issue, and I doubt it's going to change. I don't think there's going to be any real reform for at least another couple decades.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon took his post at a very critical time in international development. How do you assess his performance so far?
I think Ban Ki-moon is a progressive spirit. I think he's a believer in quiet diplomacy. Therefore, he doesn't get a lot of attention. His predecessor, Kofi Annan, as we all know, was a much larger-than-life figure and was very much more honored around the world. Ban Ki-moon is a quiet figure. He's a quiet person. He is circumspect. He's polite, but he's a person who believes in operating behind the scenes. And therefore, he doesn't have the public persona that Kofi Annan has. But I think he's done a pretty good job. I think given the limitations on that position, he's, you know, participated in a number of different crises. He went into Gaza during that conflict and tried to settle it. He has been involved in trying to stave off the humanitarian crisis in Sri Lanka. He's went into Burma, now the country called Myanmar after the cyclone to try to convince that government to open up its facilities to humanitarian aid. So he's done a lot of things which have not gotten a lot of attention, but he's been a good steward of the United Nations.
The United Nations came out, stepped up, and recently criticized the United States for its human rights records. Are we seeing a shift in policy, not only from the United Nations, but from the United States as well?
Big shift. It's the difference between black and white at this point. You had a Bush administration that did not believe in multilateralism, did not believe in the United Nations, which is one of the reasons they sent a man named John Bolton as ambassador, who didn't even believe in the organization. The new ambassador under President Obama, Susan Rice, is openly on record as believing in multilateralism. And I think she's only been in her position for a couple of months, but I think you're already starting to see changes in the way the U.S. treats the United Nations. Certainly atmospherically, when you had the U.S. as a had its representative there during the Bush years, the U.S. was scorned by most of the nations in the U.N. Now, there's a total difference. Obama is one of the most popular leaders on the planet, and you have a representative, Susan Rice, who is greeted with open arms, with affection, with a feeling that things are different now. And I think, yes, there is a total shift, which I think we will see played out over the next three or four years.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@presstv.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week, goodbye.
Press TV.
Situation in the Middle East region.
French police. This one on Saturday.
The city of London.
People. Vancouver.
United Nations.
Vienna.
The focus of international attention on.
Guarantee Bank marks the.
This year behind me. We're not doing it.
Traffic in this time of the year is.
To battle the global economic crisis.
50 Sunni tribal leaders.
Damascus. In Indian Kashmir.
New Delhi.
Jakarta.
Abuja.
Iraqis and displaced millions.
84% of the district's budget.
As President Barack Obama
have voiced hope that
has reached its highest level since
once
the U.S.
been in power in the late 90s has been given another
Gaza,
Istanbul,
Paris,
New York,
Al Khalid,
Rome,
from the Iraqi capital Baghdad,
and income assistance and
children
raising.
Were killed and hundreds more were wounded.
The five-phase election for the sixth parliamentary seat.
A group of South Korean activists launched balloons.
Beijing,
Gaza,
Los Angeles,
Al-Quds,
Madrid,
Afghanistan.
Another contentious
line towards negotiations.
Twice as fast as other comparable.
Beirut,
Kuala Lumpur,
Islamabad,
Ankara,
Seoul,
Tehran,
Dushanbe,
Tbilisi.
Press TV.